It's to the best of our knowledge from PRX. I'm Ann Strangchamps, and I'm looking for wolves.
So this is the signal from Alpha Female 926. She's the daughter of the 06 female. I got to see her chase a mountain lion up a tree this winter. Have you ever done that?
No, I guess I have.
The best place in the world to see wolves is Yellowstone National Park. And the best person to see them with is Rick McIntyre. He's a wolf biologist, and he knows the park's wolves like no one else.
I'm like a parent that would die if they missed any of their kids' recitals or baseball games or whatever. I mean, they have to be there to see everything. I did have one stretch where I was out every single day for over 15 years. The reason why I didn't go beyond 15 is I had to have a heart bypass operation. But I was back in the field on the eighth day after the operation, and I've been out every day since.
It never gets tiring? It never gets boring?
No. It would kill me to miss a day.
The reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone is one of the greatest conservation success stories in history. And Steve and I are here with Rick to see what he sees, looking through his scopes and following in his footsteps.
Look as quick as you can, it's howling.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Are these the first wild wolves you two have seen?
Yes.
Okay, congratulations. How do you feel about that?
Amazing.
Okay. You're smiling.
They're gorgeous.
Here, you could see the same wolves day after day. You could see them raise pups. You could see the pups grow up. In some cases, they would take over as the next generation. Some would fail. Some would succeed.
You must know these wolves better than you know most people who you come in contact with.
Yes, in a way, I think that's true. You learn their strengths, their weaknesses. For the most part, they have very admirable personalities. And then once in a while, you kind of find a big loser.
Give me an example of a big loser.
One of our most famous wolves was number 302. He was totally unreliable and totally undependable. He was, as far as the female wolves were concerned, very good looking, and so they flocked to him. And since there happens to be a woman reporter here, I don't know if you've ever in your life met a guy that you discovered you couldn't rely on him, you couldn't trust him. For the audience, she's nodding her head, and the male reporter is trying to act inconspicuous here. Why don't you come back and take a look? This is really a good moment. She's actually in the water now.
Wait, where?
She's wading in that pool.
Oh, yeah, there she is. Huh? How old is she?
So probably about 15 months old. So she herself was a pup a year ago.
She looks a little playful.
Yes.
Oh, now she's kind of... Mm-hmm. Oh, my God, Steve, you have to see this. Right on the water's edge.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Rick, when she's doing this, is she having fun?
You know, it'd be like a kid trying to catch a bird or a snake or a turtle. That's fun. So, to me, she's taking a lot of initiative, and that's a good sign for her future.
So, I'm curious about how it seems like for you, some wolves kind of emerge as stronger characters, personalities.
And she could be one.
Tell me the story of Wolf 21. What made him an extraordinary wolf?
Well, there's so much to his life story we could go on for hours. To start with, he happened to be born with genetics that you could argue made him the most physically superior wolf of modern times, perhaps, who ever lived. He had this athletic coordination and agility that would put him on the level of a Muhammad Ali, a Michael Jordan, Usain Bolt, you know, whatever you want to say. He was the epitome of masculine dependability. I mean, you could put him on a poster. this is what you're supposed to be like, guys. Be like Wolf 21.
How does that play out for a wolf to be so physically gifted? What can they do that other wolves can't do?
As far as we know, in his long life of 9 years, he never lost a fight. And in two occasions, I witnessed by himself to protect his family, he had to fight 6 opponents, and even then he won. As a young male, 21 was on the scene and witnessed his adopted father, who was undersized, who was the runt, who was bullied and picked on when he was young. To protect his family, 8 had to fight a much, much larger, much more aggressive, much more experienced alpha male. And somehow, 8 won the fight, and he beat up the big guy and had him in his mercy. And the way that one wolf kills another wolf is they just tear the throat out. It's an instant death. And so he had the other guy at his mercy. The other guy was on his back. His throat was exposed, and all he had to do was reach down and kill this guy. And he let him go. 21 witnessed that, and you can understand that he would never forget that. And so, as far as I know, in his long career, 21 never killed a defeated opponent. He always let him go.
You loved him, didn't you? Is that a fair word to say?
Yes, you could also say respect and admired. Yeah, all those words, sure, yeah. Have you been seeing anything?
I've got a couple of things I'd like to talk to you about.
Here, let's just come over here. Oh, hey, do you have anything right now?
So who are all these people? I mean, is there a whole kind of
culture of
wolf watchers?
There is. There is kind of definitely a culture of wolf watchers here.
And okay. I should get your name.
Yes.
So you're...
Leanna Ferguson. I'm with Yellowstone Wolf Tracker, or Wildside.
I hadn't realized it. It's such a drama. I mean, it's almost like coming out to every day for the next installment of the soap
opera.
It
is. It's kind of you want to keep up with it because things change so fast in a wolf world. I mean, overnight you can lose the alpha female of the pack, and the next morning the pack is dismantled and things are changing. So it kind of goes fast. And so being out here, it's taught me just to kind of live in the moment more.
And what makes Rick remarkable? Because I know who he is.
I could talk on and on about Rick. I think he kind of makes this community, and he's just a special guy. I think there's no one that'll ever really replace Rick out here. Anyone could talk on and on about the importance of wolves with elk and wolves with disease ecology and all of that stuff, but, like, at the end of the day, that doesn't really matter. Like, it's about stories, about connecting with humans, because if we don't connect with them, we're not going to care about them. So.
He seems to really, when he talks about the wolves, he talks about them like people.
They're his family.
What eventually happened to 21?
Well, when you do this work and you know individual animals very well and you do admire them, you have to be prepared for the likelihood that many of them die deaths that may not be pleasant to either witness or learn about. The average lifespan of wolves in Yellowstone is only 5 years. He lived to be 9 years. However, 42, who he was very devoted to, very attached to, she died in February of his final year. And I think it's fair and accurate to say that he was never the same at that point. So about 4 months after she died, it was a normal day. He was out with his family. They were resting. An elk ran by. All the wolves jumped up, including him. They chased the elk. That's what wolves do. All of them chased the elk, except for 21. And he just stood there. And then he laid down like he just didn't have the energy anymore. And I knew at that moment that we were approaching the end. That was the last time I saw him alive. So a month went by, and then some people came up, and they had been riding horses up in the mountains, and they wanted to tell me something. So they tracked me down. They said, we were up here, they had a very good description location, and here's what we saw there. We knew the area. It was the place in late summer where for many, many years, 21 and 42 would bring their family when it was hot in the valley. The hunting was better up there. There were fewer bugs. They just rested side by side, took naps together. They could lift their heads and in the meadows see their new crop of pups playing. So it'd almost be like grandparents at the summer vacation, you know, just on the porch watching, you know, all the different generations and, you know, just relaxing and, you know, the times would have been good. So we rode up there, and that's where he was. And he was on this little hill. He was under a shade tree, and he was curled up from a distance. He certainly appeared to be sleeping. And it was very poignant to think through about the situation that he used the last bit of his great strength and endurance to climb that mountain. We're pausing for a second here. We're gathering our emotions here. Yeah, and certain people are trying to control themselves here.
Even after all these years.
Yeah, it was very emotional, yeah. And, you know, all of us wolf biologists, we all kind of walked off a little bit to have, you know, some moments to ourselves. But it was the perfect end of 21's story, and that's where he wanted to be.
One final question. I don't know if you have any other questions. I've talked with some wildlife biologists who like you, live and breathe. I mean, their lives are devoted to the animals they study. And they talk about dreaming about those animals and how the animals have sort of occupied their psychic space, their unconscious. Do you dream about wolves?
Well, there was a time that I dreamed of wolves. Would you like to hear about that? So when I had to have that operation, it just happened they gave me a room where the window faced to the north. Yellowstone was to the south. What began to happen is every time I went to sleep, whether it was a nap during the day or at night, every time I had the same dream. And in the dream, I was in the hospital room. And in the dream, I would get up and I would go to the window and I would look out to the north and the wolves were there. It was the wolf pack in Lamar Valley, the Lamar Canyon wolf. And the alpha female in that group is the great-granddaughter of 21 and 42, and I knew them very well. But every time I went to sleep, I dreamed of those wolves. And then I got back here on the eighth day after the operation. We saw those exact wolves, those Lamar wolves that I had dreamed about, and I never had the dream again.
What do you make of that dream?
What do I make of that dream? You know, I haven't figured it out. I don't know. It certainly was an incentive to get back as quick as I can. So, yeah, I don't know. It's beyond me what was going on there. Yeah, I guess you could say the wolves were calling me back and they were waiting for me when I came back.
Gray moving about.
She's looking in the water. So if she sees something moving that looks edible, she'll try to catch it. Oh, folks, she got something. Yeah, she has something in her mouth. She might give it to a pup.
Rather than eat it herself?
Yeah. Watch for the pups to run to her. The pups are running after. I'm gonna as quick as you can, really, really fast, real fast.
Yes. Okay. Oh, Steve, look.
Oh yeah! Wow.
Okay. Oh my God.
We saw the pups. Oh, they're so cute.
Is that fun?
Yes, they're so cute. That was a good day. Rick McIntyre is a wolf biologist. He works for the National Park Service. And if you want to read more about him, there's a book that just came out that tells more of his story. It's called American Wolf by Nate Blakeslee. In the meantime, we put a little photo album of our day at Yellowstone up on our website at ttbook.org. The reintroduction of wolves in the West has been hugely controversial. People love seeing them in the national parks, but not so much on private land. And the same goes for their cousins, coyotes.
I was 17 years old and going out one morning with a rifle into the Red River Valley and seeing this absolutely gorgeous female coyote. I was fascinated with the West. I was romantic about the West. This was a Western animal that was showing up in my home state, and I wanted to possess it. And so she's switching her tail and throwing dewdrops in the air, this very picture of the American wilderness, and looks me directly in the eye with a look that I know is kind of posing an ancient question. And it wasn't a question I knew how to answer correctly. And so I shot her.
Find out what happened next after this. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. That 17-year-old who shot a coyote was Dan Flores, and what happened after he took the shot was not what he expected.
Suddenly, all the romance was gone from the scene. That beautiful wilderness turned out to be actually a cow pasture with soft drink bottles littering it. I could hear the grinding gears of a propane truck a half a mile away. All this romance and beauty that I had had in front of me only a moment before was gone, and I had drained it out of the scene myself. And so when I did, it was sort of like replicating the previous 150 years of American history towards coyotes in a moment's time.
Today, Dan Flores is the author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History. And coyotes are fascinating because despite having been hunted just as intensely as wolves, they survived. That's kind of mystifying because while we hunted wolves into extinction, somehow coyotes just spread everywhere. Flores told Steve Paulson how.
Well, I think what happened was that persecution in their history, which was originally imposed on them by gray wolves, the larger dog that harassed coyotes, they developed these evolutionary strategies for surviving persecution and harassment largely through interacting with wolves over the previous 30,000 years of history before we ever arrived in North America. And so when we became the new persecutor, they just sort of transferred their ability to survive under that persecution to what we were doing to them. And in fact, that persecution does lead them into a kind of a colonization mode. It sends out exploring dispersers to find new territories, and that's the primary reason why they're all over North America now.
Well, and not only in wilderness areas. I mean, they're showing up in cities. They're showing up in Los Angeles, in New York City, in Central Park even.
Oh, indeed. Central Park. New York City is really kind of the last frontier of the coyotes' range expansion. And, I mean, they've been in Los Angeles. I mean, that was coyote territory when Los Angeles was founded in the 18th century. So they've been there from the very beginning. I found good evidence, for example, that they were in the California cities of the Central Coast in the 1830s and 1840s. And in L.A., you start getting mentions of them in the beginning of the 20th century. So they've always been there. But what's kind of astonished everyone is that as cities like Los Angeles have grown into these giant megalopolis conditions, coyotes have continued to thrive right in the midst of this urban sprawl.
How do they manage to do that?
Well, for one thing, there's pretty good evidence that they've been living around us and among us ever since humans came to North America. They probably were drawn to Indian camps because, you know, for better or worse, our settlements, our human settlements produce a lot of mice and a lot of rats, and those happen to be the prey that coyotes focus on. So coyotes seem to have been drawn to human camps from the very beginning. We know they were in cities like Tenochtitlan, the capital of the Aztec Empire, now Mexico City, 1,000 years ago. And so as soon as we came up with methods to control feral dogs in modern American cities, and we got dog catchers and dog pounds and leash laws, that sort of opened up modern American cities to this invasion by coyotes.
And yet you would think that a coyote in the middle of the city would not have much place to roam. I mean, don't they have to sort of find some wild patches here and there?
And they're very good at that. Indeed, that's what they do. That's why we keep seeing them in places like Central Park and on the campus of Columbia University. And in Chicago, in the parks, along the railroad tracks, around the lake, they do seek out natural settings because, I mean, they are wild animals and they're preying primarily on rodents. But they seem to have figured out a way to not only survive in cities, but it even turns out in modern America that cities have become the equivalent of national parks for coyotes because nobody really hunts them, tries to trap them, chases them with planes or helicopters in the city. And one of the things we know that's happening now is, whereas in rural America, coyotes usually only live to about 3 years old, in cities they're getting to be 12, 13, 14 years old.
Really? That's fascinating. So what you're saying is over the course of centuries, there's been this really interesting relationship that's evolved between humans and coyotes. And I mean, they kind of thrive together, or coyotes sort of like to hang out near where humans are. And you say, in fact, that the coyote is a kind of special Darwinian mirror reflecting back insights about ourselves as fellow mammals. In what way?
Well, I think it really is, in part because coyotes are the rare animals that they not only share some of our own evolutionary adaptations. I mean, one I talk about at some length in the book is the fission fusion model. There are only a few large mammals around the world that engage in societies that can either be social, where large numbers of individuals group together for some common end, or very individualistic, where singles and pairs of individuals tend to exist. And coyotes and humans are among the few animals that tend to do both things.
In other words, there's a lot of flexibility there. I mean, you've just enormously expanded your possible habitats because you can thrive in these different circumstances.
That's exactly right. You can either exist, as in the case of coyotes, as a pack, or you can, say, bring down animals like deer, or you can exist as an individual or a pair. And in that way, sort of expand, as you mentioned, your possibilities for living in the world. So that's one of the evolutionary adaptations that we and coyotes share. And it's one of the reasons why we've both been so successful and we've both been disperser species, where we've spread around the world, in the case of coyotes, all across North America. And I think that success, that kind of success in particular, is pretty rare in the modern world, in the so-called Anthropocene, where humans sort of dominate the ecology of the planet. And the coyote happens to be another animal that does that very thing. So when we look in those golden eyes of coyotes and they look back at us, we're basically looking at a species that mirrors us in all kind of uncanny ways.
Now, there's something else about the coyote that everyone recognizes instantly, and that's the howl. They have a very distinctive howl, and which you say might be considered North America's original national anthem.
I do argue that, and I've said that in public a few times to general laughter usually, although I've noticed that after people stop laughing, they're sort of pausing and thinking a little bit about that. Because the truth is, those of us out of European backgrounds, we've only been in North America for the last 500 years, for native people only about 15,000 years. And so this is an animal whose evolutionary origins go back. I mean, it's a distinctive species, probably between a half million and 800,000 years ago. And it comes out of a line of canids. The canid family evolved in North America that goes back 5.3 million years. So this is a sound in North America that has been uttered nightly, especially in the western half of the continent, for probably a million years, long before we ever dreamed that there might be something called a North America or a United States. So it's the kind of antiquity that this animal brings to the game in its presence in North America that I sort of want people to think about when they look at it and realize we're talking about a creature that is more American than we're going to be for a very long time.
Well, I mean, the other thing that's so fascinating about the coyote is the mythic nature of this animal, especially among Native Americans. Why has the coyote assumed this almost godlike status?
That's another, I think, great kind of intersection between humans and coyotes looking one another in the eye. And I think it happened probably as long ago as 10,000 years ago at the end of the Grand Pleistocene extinctions, when so many large animals disappeared from North America. The mammoths, the mastodons, giant herds of wild horses, camels, all these animals became extinct. But one of the animals that survived the extinctions was the coyote, and native people were around to witness all this. And I think as they watched this animal that was clearly living by its wits, they saw something connate between themselves and coyotes. And that, to me, is probably the explanation for why, even as far back as the Paleolithic age, even before agriculture was invented in North America, Indian people created this body of literature of mythic oral stories with coyote functioning as the primary character and the deity that had created North America. And they use him really as kind of a human avatar, a stand-in for human beings. And that's what those stories really are about. I mean, we've talked about them as trickster stories,
right.
But I always argue that the real importance of them is not so much the trick, but why the trick works.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean that the trick works because these stories are actually about human nature and about our own weaknesses and foibles. So coyote is kind of a god who, unlike, say, a Jesus who sets a perfect example that we're supposed to aspire to, coyote represents every aspect of the human personality. I mean, in many of the stories, he's gluttonous, he's sensual, he's vindictive, he's jealous, he's narcissistic, he's a buffoon. And the stories are kind of told in order to demonstrate to people the proper way of behavior, and it's often not the way that coyote behaves.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite mythical story of coyote that you could tell us?
Well, I've got a chapter. In fact, it's the opening chapter in Coyote America, which is called Old Man America, and it's about this body of stories. And there are literally hundreds of them from 30 or more different tribes. So it was impossible. When I sat down to start working on that chapter, it was impossible to try to tell all these stories.
Mm-hmm. Could you pick just one maybe? I mean, just sort of if there's kind of a brief one that you could – it would be fun to hear.
Yeah. I picked out four of them that I thought were representative, and I'll tell you the briefest one of all. It's a story basically where coyote in this particular instance is not demonstrating the human personality of the narcissist or the buffoon, but he's actually acting on behalf of the group. And coyote is going along. Many of the stories start that way. Coyote is going along, and he becomes thirsty. And he discovers that the only water available in North America has been dammed up into a gigantic reservoir by the frog people. And so Coyote goes to the frog people and he takes them something he's found along the trail. In some of the stories, it's a particularly interesting looking stone. And he tells the frog people, I would like to trade this stone for a drink of water. And so they agree because they control the water and they only allow other beings to use the water whenever something is exchanged for the right to do so. And so Coyote gives them the stone and he proceeds to get a drink. But what the frog people began to realize is that Coyote is taking a really, really long time to drink. And finally, after several moments, long moments have passed, they peer around the edge of their dam and realize Coyote is digging at the base of the dam. And before they can stop him, he completely releases all the water, backed up behind the dam by the frog people across the world. And when the frog people confront him at this transgression, Coyote says, no one should lock up all the resources for their personal use. Something like water needs to belong to everyone. I mean, it's the kind of story that in the modern world still has relevance.
Dan Flores is the author of Coyote America, A Natural and Supernatural History, and he talked with Steve Paulson.
Was a cowboy I knew in South Texas. His face was burnt deep by the sun. Part history, part sage, part Mexican. He was there when Pancho Villa was young. And he'd tell you a tale of the old days, when the country was wild all around. Sit out under the stars of the Milky Way and listen while the coyotes howl. And they go, woo-yip, woo-yip, woo. Woo-yip, woo-yip, woo.
So we've talked about wolves and coyotes, and my dog will not forgive me if we don't at least mention dogs. So Meryl Marco also loves dogs. She's written two novels and many comic essays about our furry friends. Doug Gordon, also a dog lover, sat down to talk with her about our best friends.
Just to riff off the title of your first collection of essays, What the Dogs Have Taught Me, what do you think are the most important things that your dogs have taught you?
I'm not sure they've taught me anything. Well, they teach you resilience. I mean, they truly are stoic and bounce back with incredible buoyancy after every kind of weird thing that happens. On the other hand, they're a little bit heartless. There's a story I sometimes tell people about when I send all my dogs out in the morning to go to the bathroom, and then they come back in and I give them a cookie. This is when I had four of them, and it was a big tradition. Everybody really enjoyed it. And one day, only three of them came back, and I was waiting for the fourth one to come back, and he didn't come, and he didn't come, and I went back out and found he had fallen in the pool, and he couldn't get out. And he was desperately clawing at the side of the pool, worried and terrified, and I pulled him out, and there was no problem, and then he ran into the house for a cookie. And as I was giving out the cookies, I realized the other three had watched him almost drown and went, oh, well, that's kind of sad that he, guess he's meeting his death, but it's cookie time. So they'd all run into the house for a cookie. And that's a little heartless.
Yeah.
I guess they taught me how to be more heartless.
Yeah, I guess so. Let's try flipping the question around. What are the most important things that you, Meryl Marco, have taught your dogs?
Geez, I teach them precious little. I keep trying to teach them the same few things. Stop pulling on the leash and And I always bring a dog trainer in every time I get a new dog. And they always, when the dogs are with the trainer, the dogs turn into boy or girl scouts immediately and are saluting and doing everything perfect. And then the trainer leaves and they're yanking me around. I'm told that I don't assert myself enough. And that's what I've taught my dogs, is that it's easy to push me around.
Comedy writer Meryl Marco talking about the mutual education that is part of our love affair with dogs. She's written two novels about dogs and a collection of essays called What the Dogs Have Taught Me. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX.
I'm searching through these documents for the history of my race, hoping to organize the information before it disintegrates into a chaos of dust. We are a race of monsters, recently created, so our history is short. I'm reading the writings of our founder, a Prussian scientist who drew up the plans for us in 1882, but our race did not come into being until nearly a century later. The name of the scientist was Augustus Rank, and he conceived the idea of a race of super-intelligent dogs with artificial hands and voice boxes to be used for military purposes, and devoted his life to creating them. He was fascinated by prosthetic devices, the possibilities. Many hideous animals were made before we were perfected.
That's Kirsten Bacchus reading from her novel Lives of the Monster Dogs. The book came out 20 years ago, and it's been a sleeper cult favorite ever since. And it's just been reissued, so if you missed it the first time, here's your chance. So who or what are these monster dogs? That's just what Doug wanted to know.
Kirsten, where did the idea for your novel, Lives of the Monster Dogs, come from?
I've always been fascinated by humans' relationship to non-human animals, and dogs in particular, in that kind of tragedy of their position as citizens of our world. You know, they're not like cats, where they really do very well living on their own without humans. Mm-hmm. They sort of need us, and yet they're not part of our world. They're treated as property in our world, and they're not valued. So that situation was always very compelling to me. So that's part of where it came from.
My favorite character in the novel is Ludwig von Sacker, and he's a black German shepherd who wears glasses, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a bit about him?
Yeah, he's a very melancholy character. He's trying to record the history of the monster dogs, and he's trying to understand sort of where they came from or what their purpose is. He's reading Runk's diaries and trying to understand what his purpose was in creating the monster dogs, and what their purpose is now that he is gone and they don't have a leader anymore. At the same time, his own consciousness is sort of disintegrating. Something is happening to him and the other dogs mentally. They're having memory lapses and lapses back into to dog-like behavior. And so he feels himself fighting against, you know, this against the loss of his own mind and sort of racing against the clock to try to get their history down and try to understand what he's here for before he loses his mind.
Yeah. Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from Lives of the Monster Dogs and, appropriately enough, an excerpt from Ludwig's diaries.
They live like famous people, keeping away from crowds and employing others to do their shopping, occasionally appearing on talk shows or writing autobiographies. They're well received by fascinated audiences. But they aren't aware of the mixture of amusement and revulsion people feel at the sight of pinschers and Rottweilers stepping from a limousine, dressed like 19th century Prussians with their monocles and parasols. They look like ugly parodies of humans, and their biographies read like social satire. They will never be seen as anything but caricatures of human beings. There's no place for monsters in this world. That is why I prefer not to live with them. But of course, there's no place for me here, away from them, either. Standing at the window, leaning on my cane, it's not comfortable for me to stand unsupported on my hind legs. I can see the humans walking their dogs. There's a small, cold rain, almost a fog, and I'm holding my pince-nez in my hand, so they appear to me as vague shapes under the street lamps, fuzzy around the edges, as if they're disintegrating. The dogs that live around here are small, and they smell of nervousness, stupidity, and shampoo. I feel no kinship with them.
While I was reading your book, I couldn't help but think of the famous expression, man's best friend. Dogs are often considered to be men's, we should say, and women's best friends. But in Lives of the Monster Dogs, man, in the form of Dr. Augustus Ronk and his assistants, is really a dog's worst enemy. And you explore a lot of themes about the ways we mistreat dogs and other animals. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible what we do to other non-human animals. I don't know where to start with it. I was vegetarian starting when I was a child, when I was 11, because I sort of realized that meat is animals and I didn't want to eat them. And we have such a strange attitude towards them. You know, we'll do things to a pig that if somebody did them to a dog, everybody would be calling the police. And yet it happens on a massive scale every day in animal agriculture to animals that we don't consider as worthy as dogs for whatever reason. I mean, you know, and then we make up reasons like dogs are smarter, but they're not smarter than pigs, or, you know, they can't feel pain anymore or less than pigs can. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, we just very much use animals. You know, the bottom line is that we like to have dogs around our house, and it's inconvenient to have pigs around our house. So it's kind of all about us. And I think that's slowly changing. I mean, it's changed hugely in the years since I wrote Monster Dogs, and that's very exciting for me to see. So I think the tide is turning, but it's hard. It's hard to see ourselves in others, especially in others who can't fight back and don't have a voice of their own, you know?
Yeah. As you say, the tide is turning. It's a slow turning. It's not turning as quickly as we would like it to, but at least it's turning in the right direction.
Yeah.
The idea of animal intelligence looms large. What does animal intelligence mean to you?
Well, you know, that's such an interesting question because we always measure their intelligence against our own, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they can figure out what we're saying to them, we think they're intelligent, but we don't measure our intelligence by whether we can figure out what they're trying to say to us. You know, what does that mean? I mean, each creature has an intelligence that's suited to who they are. And, you know, of course, we judge everything on a scale that puts us at the top and ranks everything beneath us.
Sure. The way we humans think is we automatically assume that our way of thinking is superior to an animal's way of thinking. We don't necessarily know that.
Yeah. I mean, what does it mean, superior? I mean, if we're the ones who define what superior means, then of course ours is going to be superior.
Yeah. The fact that these monster dogs have this extra intelligence, the questions related to animal intelligence were something you were grappling and working your way through while writing the book, right?
Yeah, I mean, definitely that was something that was on my mind. And I mean, I think in the book it says that their intelligence is enhanced. And I think that thinking back on that now, I would ask myself what that means. Like, it was altered in some way to be more human-like or more adapted to living in human culture, you know.
So have you come up with an answer as to what it means all these years later, how their intelligence was enhanced? Or is that still a mystery to you?
I guess that's a mystery. Dogs are already so tuned into humans. I mean, they're basically psychic because that's how they live. That's their livelihood, is figuring out what humans want from them. But, you know, would they, like, reading? I don't know. Some dogs can read. I mean, I've heard of a couple dogs that you could write, you know, a short word on an index card and they know what it means. Like, you could write sit. There was one guy, Daniel Pinkwater. He had a dog, Lulu, who could read. That's the one I'm thinking of, actually. And she could say her name, too. She used to say, Lulu. Yeah.
You do a magnificent job of inhabiting the emotional and the psychological reality of what it might feel like to be these monster dogs, these dogs that have human hands and enhanced intelligence and are able to speak. I'm curious about how you were able to do that. Did you try to think like a dog, or even like, and take that a step further and think like a monster dog? How did you get inside their heads?
You know, I've come to think it's kind of a mystical process. I mean, there was part of me that resisted looking at it that way. I sort of wanted it to all make sense and to have some rational way to explain it. But it's, you know, it's art, and there's just spirit involved in it. I mean, part of it is you somehow invoke some consciousness that isn't yours and reach out to it, and you honor it, you treat it like it's real, and it becomes real to you in some way. I think that's part of the process. And, you know, whether that's a person who's different from you or a creature of a different species, there's some element of channeling it in there, I think, of something that's not, it's not within the bounds of your normal consciousness and who you are. It's just a little bit outside of those bounds, and you have to reach for it and find it out there, I think.
Yeah, it seems you have to reach even further, though, when it's, as you mentioned, like when it's a different species and a species that has had these horrific acts performed upon it to modify it and make it more human-like. It seems to me you've got to go even deeper into your imagination.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, the other thing is that we here are humans judging how well I did at capturing a dog's consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if a dog would agree.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, is Lulu still around? We got to call up Pinkwater and get Lulu to read it.
Yeah.
And offer a review. So one of the things that I find incredibly poignant and heartbreaking is that the monster dogs know that they're going to die. And as far as we know, regular dogs don't know that they're going to die. So it raises the question, is it better to be aware of the fact that you're going to die at some point? What do you think?
I don't know. If we could know the date and manner of our own deaths, would we want to know it? I don't know the answer.
No, I don't think any of us
I guess it would vary.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Was this idea that the monster dogs are aware of their mortality, was that something you thought about? Did that inform the way you wrote about the characters, the monster dogs, as they were getting ill towards the end of the book?
I mean, it definitely informed how I thought of their situation. I mean, I guess I felt that they were, that they were creatures who had limited time, and there was something unnatural about their existence, something wrong, you know, I think that, and that kind of is part of why they couldn't last. They weren't really meant to be in the world in a way.
Yeah.
They weren't, they were neither dog nor human, and they had been changed from what they were supposed to be, and so I think that sense of them not being able to hold on to the world definitely was part of what I was feeling as I was writing the book.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason why the whole novel, but especially the ending, the last few chapters about why it resonated so strongly with me, because it's a sort of like a universal existential question. And for an outsider like myself and someone who struggles with depression a lot, that's something like I often feel that I'm not meant to be in the world. So yeah, that was really well done.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of temporary for all of us, right? It isn't right. There are always things wrong while you're in the world, and ways that you don't match up with the world that you find yourself in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that I think that's a that's almost like a universal feeling, I think.
Yeah. Towards the end of your story, the monster dogs start to become ill. And since they're unable to reproduce, that means that their kind is going to die out. And it's very, very poignant and very sad. And now would be the perfect time to have you read an excerpt from a scene in which Cleopyra, your human character, is talking to the monster dog Ludwig after Ludwig has become ill. Could you read this for us?
Sure. Okay. Okay, this is Cleo talking to Ludwig. Are you afraid of the future? I asked him once. We were sitting in his kitchen at a low butcher block table drinking tea. An assortment of huge pots that hung from the ceiling, little used now, gave a gentle coppery tint to the dim afternoon. I don't think so, he said. I expect it will be a welcome release. What will? Whatever comes next. There are still so many things to do. I should like to write extensively about Ranxier's with his followers, for instance. How he obtained and kept their loyalty. There are papers I have hardly looked at, which might shed some light on that question, and I think that would be quite interesting. But at some point one wants to be taken away, to feel a hand on the shoulder and hear, "Come, you have done enough." Don't you agree? But you don't have to wait for somebody to say it, I said. You can always stop working on one thing and do something else, can't you? No, I must keep working on my project. But you are young. Not so incredibly much younger than you. Ludwig's mouth opened in a slight smile and he shook his head. The scientists in all their wisdom were not able to slow down our aging process quite enough to match yours. After a certain point, it begins to go very quickly with us. Even if it were not for the illness, you know this already, you can see it. But you don't seem old enough to give everything up, Ludwig. He gave me a look of intense, blurred sadness and then picked up the remains of a lemon slice from his saucer and held it absent-mindedly in his hand. One would not willingly give everything up, he said, but the time comes. Also, he said, there would be no point in living if I were entirely mad. But you wouldn't ever kill yourself, would you? What difference does it make? Of course, I would have to do it before I lost my mind completely. Afterward, I would not be able to. Perhaps I would not remember that I had meant to. So in that sense, I suppose some time would be lost. You can't do that, I said. Ludwig smiled again, in a secret, bitter way that I didn't like. You wouldn't be able to prevent me. But Cleo, why must we talk about this? Even if it were to happen, it would be far in the future.
Kirsten Bacchus, reading from her novel Lives of the Monster Dogs. Doug Gordon talked with her. And that's it for our show today. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced this hour, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, and Karen McKechnie. Joe Hartke is our technical director, Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.